Then I tried to do myself exactly what she had done, and to my great joy, found that I too could bring about a certain amount of relief, and overcome the worst of the pain, and sometimes mercifully eliminate it altogether. In other words, Mrs. Hodson to a greater extent, and myself in a lesser, were able to demonstrate the power of enabling the etheric and physical counterparts to reunite, thus inducing a state of wholeness again, in which pain cannot exist. We persisted in our efforts to make the best of the conditions, but the disease ran its course. Natural sleep became almost a stranger to my husband, and with the help of another dear friend, a nurse was found to look after him at night. She usually came in about 10 o'clock, and stayed till 7 o'clock next morning, so that I could go downstairs and get a few hours' sleep. Anticipating, through bitter experience, the certainty of a sleepless night for himself, my husband used to put off all preparation for the night as long as possible, such as washing, bed making, etc., so as to make the long, dark hours seem shorter. How he hated those hours when I was not with him! Yet he insisted on my going into another room to try and rest, knowing whoever was with him would stand no chance of rest, as he himself was so intensely restless and nervy at night, and needed constant attention in many ways. The nurse had arranged to be on duty 6 nights out of the 7, and I was allowed to take charge of the patient again on Saturday nights, because I could get a certain amount of rest the following day, as it was Sunday, and I had no professional duties to attend to. I knew my husband would love me to be with him on that one night in each week. When he heard we had arranged it, his face lit up with pleasure, so when it drew near to the end of the week, both nurse and I were puzzled by his very urgent demand that another nurse should be specially engaged for the coming Saturday night, but our bewilderment was ended when he confided to nurse that he wanted someone to come in just for a short time on Saturday evenings to give him a strong injection of morphine in the hope that it had only succeeded once, send him into a heavy sleep, and thus enable me to rest. Both nurse and I realized his utter unselfishness in making this request, as he hated and feared the effect of the drug. So things being as they were, nurse and I made up our minds to make the best of things for him as far as we possibly could, and always postponed, as I have said, all necessary preparations for the night until the last possible moment, which meant that nurse washed him about 11:30, and I waited up till she had finished, and was ready to place him onto a couch while we made the bed. He was very difficult to move, and I always helped her in this task, which meant that sometimes I had to wait until 12 or 12:30 midnight, and in order to keep myself from becoming drowsy after a long and tiring day, I used to take a walk along the seafront by myself. Peace seemed to come to me on the long stretch of unfrequented promenade. Sometimes I quickly walked its entire length, which was a matter of 3/4 of a mile, 2 or 3 times, before returning home to help nurse and say good night to my husband. Early in February, 1935, there seemed to have been a slight but definite improvement in his condition. Certain symptoms had disappeared, and it seemed as if there was a possibility of recovery. Nurse and I had discussed it, quite hopefully, one Sunday morning, then a sudden weakness seemed to set in, which I hoped was only a temporary setback, but I felt rather disappointed about it, after the plans for certain treatments, diet, etc., that nurse and I had evolved together. On Monday, February 11, I went out at my usual time, about 11 o'clock, and walked up the promenade to the point where I usually turn and come back again. Just as I was within 20 or 30 yards of this point, I became aware of a vague, shadowy form on my right, walking along beside me, step by step. Then I heard a voice, my husband's voice, say distinctly, "Don't worry, little woman, don't worry." I was so surprised I did not answer. I simply walked the few remaining steps, turned, and walked straight back home, instead of continuing my walk to the opposite end of the seafront. It seemed very strange to me, because, though I was familiar with the idea of these exteriorizations of the etheric body, and I was quite convinced that it was my husband's etheric body that had walked beside me, and had spoken to me, I had taken it for granted that the physical body must be asleep in order that the etheric should be able to manifest in a complete and separate manner. Knowing that at that very moment nurse would be washing and otherwise attending to her patient, and that he would be quite wide awake, I was very puzzled indeed. On my arrival home I went immediately to the bedroom, and on seeing me open the door, nurse put her finger to her lips, and signaled me to enter quietly. Coming round the corner of the screen that excluded drafts from his bed, I saw that he was in a very deep sleep, a sleep such as he had not had for a long time. So the conviction that it really had been his etheric self that spoke to me strengthened considerably. He slept much better that night than usual, and awoke in the morning apparently quite free from pain. I said nothing to him, but after nurse had gone away for the day, he said to me, "Do you know I've been out on the seafront?" I answered, "Yes, I know." He said, "How do you know?" "Because I heard you speak to me."
"Did I?"
he remarked. "I don't remember speaking to you. I only know I was on the seafront, and I didn't know how I got there. I also remember that I have been with other people, talking to them." This experience made me quite certain that my husband's soul body was loosening its hold on the physical counterpart in spite of the recent improvement in his condition. I relived in memory the other occasions in which I had seen and felt the exteriorized etheric body while the individual was actually alive on the physical plane. My personal experience has proved to me that when I see the double of anyone I know, it is a sign that that person is going to pass away from earth conditions within a limited time. The actual period elapsing between my witnessing this phenomenon and the physical death varies considerably, the shortest time being 2 days before, and the longest about 2 years. There have been only two cases in which the interval has been so long as 2 years, but in both cases the individuals were vigorous, apparently healthy people of only middle age. One would have expected them to be good for at least another 20 or 30 years, and they were considered to be remarkably fit and well by all who knew them. In one instance I saw two people at the same moment. They were unknown to each other, but I had known them both for several years. One Sunday afternoon in winter I walked into a room in a friend's house, and to my amazement, sitting on a couch, was the figure of a man whom I was expecting to meet on the Monday following. The figure was quite distinct in every detail. I stared at it for a moment, looked away, then looked back at the couch. My friend had disappeared, but a kind of misty patch appeared rather at the side of the place where I had seen him. A face built rather indistinctly in this mist, then gradually took definite shape. Naturally, I expected to see the same person materialize. But to my surprise, a different face built up, yet with a striking resemblance to the first one. As it happened, there were several features of a rather striking similarity, such as the cut and color of the hair and mustache. Also the complexion and the general contours of the faces were somewhat alike. Here resemblance finished, as one man was considerably taller than the other. As the second face and form took more definite shape, I recognized it as belonging to a man whom I had seen that very morning, and who was at that moment enjoying a game of golf. This form also only stayed for a moment, but it was long enough for me to be quite sure of the evidence of my own eyes. Well, the first man died 2 days later, and the second one 2 years after. The first one was unknown to me, taken suddenly ill at the time, but the second was to all intents and purposes quite well. On another occasion I went out to do some shopping, and while crossing a patch of waste ground, I noticed an extremely strong scent of sweet peas. It was as if a large bunch of them, fresh and fragrant, was held close to my face. After about half a minute it disappeared. A quarter of an hour later, while looking in the window of a confectioner's shop, it came again, more strongly than ever. I looked around, with my usual caution, but could see nothing to account for it. Some derelict building land on one side, and a small bungalow with nothing in the garden except a grass plot and some ramblers and chrysanthemums not yet in bloom on the other side of the cake shop. I moved on and looked in another shop about 400 yards from the first, and the scent came again. I racked my brains to think what the meaning of it was, because these things do not come to me often and there is always some definite reason for their presence when they do. I had never been specially fond of sweet peas, but I remembered one very close friend who had a great affection for them, and on the last occasion when I stayed in her house she had filled my bedroom with them, and had also given me a large bunch to take home the next morning. We had had quite a long conversation about the merits of sweet peas, particularly about their scent, and we both remarked that the variety she grew had an especially sweet and strong perfume. This incident came very clearly into my mind as the only one that could have any connection with my present experience, but I could not see its import at the time, as I knew my friend was alive and well. A few days later another friend, who knew the one who gave me the sweet peas, and I went walking beside the sea, when quite suddenly, in the midst of discussing a subject that interested us both very much, I felt my first friend beside me, and a feeling of deep depression and sorrow came upon me. So strong was it that I stopped walking, and cried out to the friend who accompanied me, "Oh! I feel that Mrs. B is here, and that something is happening to her, something that is sad and terrifying. I feel awfully upset. Something is very wrong with her." My friend wondered what it could be. Our afternoon's outing was spoilt, as the depressing condition did not wear off so quickly as it usually does with me. Chapter 6. Rolling the stone from the grave away. Very soon after I heard that Mrs. B had that very afternoon been to see a specialist to whom she had been sent by a doctor, she had been suffering from what she thought were rheumatic pains, and she went to the examination quite light-heartedly. To her horror she was told that she was suffering from malignant cancer in its worst form, and that she had only a short time to live. It was a great shock, as she had relatives on the earth to whom she was devoted, and many interests and philanthropic work. She hardly knew how she got home, she was scarcely conscious of her surroundings, and sometime during the latter part of the day she had a kind of seizure from which she recovered only to face the usual course of the dread disease, which she did with courage and fortitude, once the surprise and shock had worn off. Later, she passed to the other side, dying peacefully, even cheerfully, knowing, as she fortunately did, that our human lives are only a mortal stage, of which death happens to be a part, and that the promise of rest, which all religions hold out to the tired sufferer, is not a long and endless sleep, nor is it a condition of apathy or unconsciousness regarding those we love, either on the earth or over there. Goethe expresses it beautifully when he says, "Rest is not quitting the busy career, rest is the putting of self to the sphere. 'Tis the brook's motion, clear without strife, fleeing to ocean, after its life. 'Tis loving and serving, the highest and best, 'tis onward unswerving, and that is true rest." As I remarked before, these and other experiences have proved to me that whenever I see the double, it is either that of someone already passed over, or someone who is drawing near to doing so. I think that in many cases the soul knows long before the physical self that the time is soon coming when it will have to depart from the earthly body and the earthly life, and as soon as this stage in consciousness is reached by the soul, a loosening takes place. The etheric body gradually begins to free itself from the trammels of the physical, and takes journeys or excursions on its own, as if it were trying its wings, or endeavoring to make itself familiar with the new stage of existence in which it will shortly be functioning permanently. Many people who have studied spiritual and psychical laws are often aware of these etheric experiences, and bring back a more or less perfect memory of them when they return to the physical, but without the conscious realization of the infinite possibilities of their own soul bodies. Others may have the actual astral experience, but they don't remember it afterwards. I am aware that many people may have seen the etheric doubles of people who are known to them, and who do not die soon afterwards. If this is so, then I think we can trace the cause to one of two reasons, the most likely being that the seer is undoubtedly the possessor of clairvoyant powers which may only function occasionally and unexpectedly, and the second explanation may be that the exteriorizer has become somewhat proficient in the art of exteriorizing his etheric body, as undoubtedly has happened in many cases. In the Nottingham Evening Post, two stories of doubles of members of Parliament having been seen in the House of Commons were retold by a writer quite recently. Sir Carney Rusk, it is stated, was seen by several other MPs in the House at a time when he was actually ill in bed. Sir Gilbert Parker has stated about this occasion, when Rusk accepted my nod with what looked very like a glare, and met my kindly inquiry with silence, I was a little surprised. And when he suddenly and silently vanished, I put my hand to my head in utter bewilderment, and asked myself if it were possible that poor Rusk, whose illness had been reported in the papers, had died. Sir Arthur Hayter also saw this apparition of Rusk, and about it he said, "I am positive that I saw Sir Carney Rusk. I was struck by two peculiarities: his extreme pallor, and his unhimselfishness, and by the fact that he occupied a seat remote from his usual place." Some years ago, Dr. Mark Anthony MacDonald was seen in the precincts of the House by fellow members on two consecutive days, when he had not left his own room during those 2 days. This spirit also recorded a vote in the division lobby. A strange case indeed, this, for men who knew him well were prepared to swear they had seen him. We know so little of the reason behind this particular phenomenon because we have not studied the subject sufficiently. Speaking personally, I don't think that I have developed normal clairvoyance to the extent that would enable me to see anyone's double easily. I don't see auras, as so many people do. It is only on rare occasions that I am blessed with this power of being able to see something that evidently lies just beyond the range of our normal vision. I know that there is a world of wonderful beauty both of sight and sound that lies just outside our ordinary consciousness, waiting for us to take the initiative. I feel that it would be beneficial for the whole human race if we knew more. Mark, I don't say all, because we shall have to be content with one step at a time, but one step inevitably leads to another, and the higher we ascend, the nearer we get to perfect truth. I read somewhere, "Oh, well, for us all some sweet hope lies deeply buried from human eyes. And in the hereafter, angels may roll the stone from the grave away." Not only in the hereafter may the angels roll the stone away, they will cooperate with us and do it now if we wish it. If we exert all our strength and determination to live a spiritual life here and now, we can learn of those things that are at present deeply buried from human eyes. They are only buried because we have obscured our own vision and dulled our hearing by our complete absorption in the struggles and woes of our earthly lives. Longfellow said that our todays and yesterdays are the blocks with which we build. This is true, and if we use only blocks of a gross and material kind, we shall not be able to visualize that fine and noble structure that we might be building, and if we do not accustom ourselves to an awareness of beauty around us, we cannot become aware of that which is just beyond, yet such a little way beyond our range. It need not be so. It will not be so in a comparatively short time, when we have increased our knowledge and appreciation of life in its higher aspects. Chapter 7. Every Galvary has an Olivet. Directly I realized that the end of my husband's physical life was indeed drawing rapidly to its close, I turned all my thoughts and energies to helping him to accomplish the great change that lay before him. The doctor and nurse had warned me that the nature of his illness would most certainly terminate in a very difficult and trying passing. Indeed, the doctor had begged me for my own sake as well as my husband's to let him go into a nursing home to die, but knowing his love of home, and dislike of strange places, I felt I must keep him in his accustomed surroundings at all costs. I suspected that the doctor, in the kindness of his heart, wanted to save me from what he believed would be a distressing and exhausting ordeal. In opposition to this idea of the physical aspect of the case, I had a positive, overwhelming conviction that there were ways in which I could assist my husband, ways by which I could help him to gently and peacefully loosen his hold on the poor pain-ridden body. I prayed fervently that my mind would be receptive to the right suggestions from a higher plane, and that certain friends who had passed to the beyond some time previously would be allowed to come and help one whom they knew so well, among them being two who were doctors during their earth lives. I begged them, if it were not against God's will that they should do so, to impress me what to do both physically and mentally for my husband, and I also asked that they should help him on the spiritual plane, both before, during, and after his passing. I am sure that in these times of sorrow and impending separation, the two worlds, physical and etheric, draw very near to each other. It is one of God's merciful dispensations that a wider vision is given to us then, the way is opened, and would-be helpers over the break through the veil, and reveal themselves to us as ministering angels indeed. They help willingly and joyfully, sorry for our sadness, but glad for the sake of the one who is about to shed his physical body and join them. How beautifully George MacDonald expressed it when he wrote, "I think that death has two sides to it, one sunny and one dark, as this round earth in every day half sunny and half dark. We on the dark side call the mystery death, they on the other, looking down in light, wait the glad birth with other tears than ours." Yes, they wait the glad birth, and if only we would ask for their cooperation in the right spirit, with the right motive, they would impress those on the dark side what to do for the patient, and what not to do. For the first time since my husband's illness commenced, I felt impressed to give up my professional work entirely for the time being, and to devote myself to doing all I could to cooperate in making everything as easy as possible. Now, my husband had always been very difficult about diet and taking care of himself in any shape or form. He had been advised to drink plenty of pure water to help clear his kidneys of some of the accumulated poisons that they contained as a result of every kind of tropical disease and fever that he, as he put it himself, seemed to have had a perfect gift for contracting in his earlier years. All forms of starchy food were bad for him, but he loved them, and refused to drink plain water. Strong tea, that had been standing sometimes for 2 hours in the teapot, was his favorite beverage, sugar and sweets, extremely rich cakes and puddings of every description were the foods he liked best. So you can imagine I was not very hopeful when the first impression I was given by our unseen helpers was to give him plenty of water to drink. This message came to me very clearly and definitely, while my patient was dozing the day after I had seen his double on the seafront. As soon as he awoke, he asked me to give him a drink of water. To say I was astonished at such a request from him is putting it mildly, but I put it down to the influence of our friends over there. When I handed him the glass, he said, "They told me to drink water." I asked, "Who told you?" But he only answered, "They said I must drink water." Up to that time he had enjoyed the food I had given him, but now he waved it aside and asked again for water if I did not give it him as often as he wished for it. He had never been fond of fruit, but I got some good grapes, skinned them, and took out the seeds, and gave him the pulp and juice only, which he now took eagerly. With the exception of a little weak China tea now and again, this was all the food he took. Even if they will take it, I am convinced that the dying do not need nourishment. To nourish the worn-out physical envelope which the soul is trying its best to shake off is only to create and prolong an unnecessary struggle between the two bodies. In many cases it does not even strengthen the physical, because it can no longer make use of solid food, which only clogs the system, and produces more pain and suffering. Death should be a letting go, and one of my objects in recording these details is to endeavor to help people to assist in this loosening process. The administration of drugs, morphine, for instance, is simply an artificial method of assisting what ought to be a perfectly natural and easy transition from the physical to the etheric body. Somehow I knew that my husband's passing would be easy, especially if I obeyed the impressions that came so subtly, yet so unmistakably into my mind, and the day following his surprising request for water, something happened which pleased me very much. He had been sleeping, in fact, he was now sleeping more peacefully than he had done during the whole course of his illness, though only in comparatively short spells. As soon as he awoke, he turned to me and said, "I have been in a beautiful place, a beautiful institution. Do tell me who runs it, it is run so marvelously." No description that I could give in words would in any degree convey a true conception of the joy and wonderment that transfigured his face when he spoke these few words to me. The very tones of his voice were tinged with an almost breathless gratitude. I think that the atmosphere of the place that he had visited had given him such a feeling of hope and security that he was not very perturbed at finding no ordinary explanation of the occurrence. During that last week he went several times to the beautiful institution. I long to know more details, but dare not plague him with questions in his increasingly weak state. It was sufficient joy to me to see the altered expression of his face, and the glad tones of his voice when he mentioned his experiences. Not for a long time had I seen such evidence of happiness on his poor emaciated face, and his voice had impressed its tones of pain on my memory to such an extent that I had temporarily forgotten what it sounded like when he was really and truly happy. Now, at the time which I had dreaded for so long, all the sting and sorrow of death were alleviated. This trying time had its compensation. It seemed as if Giles' words were true, and that every Calvary has an Olivet. To every place of crucifixion there is likewise a place of ascension. The sun that was shrouded is unveiled, and heaven opens with hopes eternal to the soul which was nigh unto despair. To an old friend who was one of the very few who visited him during that period, he several times spoke of these other places he had visited, and said he had been told by the people there that he was not to eat anything, but to drink plenty of water. I have since learned that the drinking of water strengthens the etheric body, and enables it to assert itself more strongly in its endeavor to separate itself permanently from its physical counterpart, with which it is connected by an etheric cord, sometimes called the silver cord, which binds it to the physical body during its period of earthly life. This cord is never severed until death takes place. A great deal of the apparent difficulty or struggling associated with death is caused by the inability of the etheric to dissociate itself from the physical envelope. Some people are more firmly fixed in the physical state than others. It is, I think, partly a matter of temperament, and of physical and spiritual understanding, but a consciousness of the existence of the etheric body, and a realization of its powers of dissociation or separate existence would go a long way to producing the phenomenon more easily than is possible under the present conditions in which human beings are only cognizant of one body that is the physical. Chapter 8. Practical Methods of Helping the Dying. This last week of my husband's earth life was not an unhappy period, yet one could not help feeling the inevitable sadness of the parting to come obviously so soon. There was a peace in the air which had been lacking during the long months of trying to fight pain and discomfort, often unavailingly. Possibly our efforts had held a quality of stress, which never helps to create an atmosphere of peace. Many times I repeated to myself the words, "Drop thy still dews of quietness, till all our strivings cease, take from our souls the strain and stress, and let our ordered lives confess the beauty of thy peace." Here I want to give a word of advice that at one time I should have thought to have been unnecessary, but experience has shown me that it is badly needed. When the time of severance draws near, the soul and mind of the patient need absolute peace. Very often someone tiptoes quietly into the sick room, and holds a whispered conversation with the nurse, or whoever is in attendance. The conversation may be about the patient, or it may drift from him to other things. Whatever the subject may be, don't talk about it in the room. Go outside and discuss it. You may think the patient is unconscious, or partly so, and doesn't know what is happening. No, his conscious mind may not be cognizant, but now his unconscious or subjective mind is gradually coming to the surface. That greater part of the mind that cannot express itself through the limited physical brain is now beginning to assert itself. It is the soul mind. And because the soul is beginning to detach itself from the earthly body, the subjective or larger mind finds itself functioning imperfectly and intermittently in both bodies. Probably it functions more completely in the etheric brain and body, but until the etheric is permanently dissociated from the physical, this mind will find itself occasionally floating into the physical brain, and recording flashes of awareness as to what is happening to, or around, the physical body. At this juncture it is most important that whatever is being done or said, or even thought in the room, should be directed towards the patient to help him, and should not degenerate into a kind of trivial chatter about the patient, or any other topic. If this is allowed, he will be disturbed, puzzled, and in an effort to understand what is going on around him, his mind will fasten onto the physical brain more tenaciously than is good for it. All our efforts should now be concentrated on making it easy for the soul and mind to free themselves from the physical mind. We must not try to do it for him. That would be unwarrantable interference with the natural progress of events, but we must do all in our power to assist the patient's soul to do it for itself.